Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson. Joining me today is my co-host, Bryce. Bryce, how you doing?
Doing all right, Terry. How you doing tonight?
I am doing presentable. I recently had to take care of my spouse's cat, who was being very affectionate and who doesn't like petting a cat. And then I remembered I'm intensely allergic to cats. So right now I am on an antihistamine that is actually literally not legal to sell in the United States that I get periodically when I visit Canada, because it's the only thing that will prevent me from wanting to die if I accidentally pet a cat. Right now, the path to ascension in my head, real clear. Additionally, so are my sinuses. Good trade-off. I also think I get a permanent point of quiet.
That sounds like a pretty excellent antihistamine.
Yeah.
Good job. Thanks, Canada.
Thanks, Canada. Go up there and get my cyclamates and my desloratadine. But today we are talking about paranormal investigation. This as a genre is something that has been in the pop culture zeitgeist for a while, but I don't think that there have been many RPGs that have really figured it out, at least not the modern incarnation that kind of revolves around that SCP-esque weird happenings things. So there are good games and there are popular games. I've yet to see one that really has broken through. This is my polite way of saying I wish more people played the Esoterrorists.
I mean, in addition to the Esoterrorists, Terry, I mean, we have Call of Cthulhu, which is the second longest running, second non-D&D or D&D derivative most popular role-playing game out there. We have that one. We have Ghostbusters. We have Chill. We have Monster of the Week, Trail of Cthulhu, Deltagrine. There's a couple of World of Darkness and Chronicles of Darkness games that are set around paranormal investigation.
Which would you consider to be set around paranormal investigation?
Hunter the Vigil, the current Hunter the Reckoning 5th edition, more so than the revised. I mean, it's not my favorite, but it's there. as well as The Hunter's Hunted and the offshoots of that.
So the problem I have with a lot of those is that I don't think they quite seal the deal on providing a world where investigation frequently occurs as it does in other paranormal investigation media and TV. So it is often the case of understand it enough to kill it or understand it enough to subdue it. I generally don't encounter games that have kind of that rich understory that try and create a world where you're kind of in the agency that is dealing with it. So for instance, Hunter the Vigil certainly asks at what price. That I get. Ghostbusters is an example. That's a bit of a dumpster fire system.
Hey, it was the early 80s.
Yeah. 80s. And Trail of Cthulhu, so one genre staple of, I would argue, of paranormal investigation is your character gets to investigate more than one paranormal thing, where that is not necessarily guaranteed or even encouraged in Call of Cthulhu.
Hey, you could definitely have a character that survives your first encounter. It's a possibility. Running away is always an option, Terry.
You are right. So let's go over what I kind of think are kind of the four walls of what these are. So what do I consider kind of the cornerstones of paranormal investigation? This is a genre where one investigates a world where paranormal activity exists and in some way, and it is not widespread, or at least not widely known, in the sense that most everyday people would not be aware of this. When I look into it, I look into the side of it that is kind of more of a subset of science fiction, where the entities and so on kind of observe their own set of rules or have some sort of occult physics. The clearest one that comes to mind for me would be all of the God Machine Chronicle and Chronicles of Darkness, although I would argue that Chronicles of Darkness is aggressively opposed to explaining the nature of the God Machine, which kind of limits the depth of investigation one gets to do in that as a game. So where do you kind of put paranormal investigation as a genre?
I mean, anything that involves hunting down monsters and entities and, for want of a better word, magical trinkets is pretty firmly in the fantasy camp in my book. Just because magic has rules doesn't mean it isn't fantasy.
Yeah, I guess the side I generally find more interest in is the slightly more scrutable. There is a center to the maze, even if we don't get it. Frequently, though, we see protagonists with special powers or access to special powers or materials. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, someone being the chosen one. What comes to mind for you when you're like special protagonists that get to do special things and not just because they're the heroes?
Well, Ghostbusters. Not everybody can walk around with an unlicensed nuclear accelerator on their back.
Plus a muon trap.
Obviously.
Which I think brings the total number of uses to muons to 3. There is often a location of importance. The strongest touchstone for me in the paranormal investigation genre, especially this new serialized multi-entity warehouse variant seemingly, is the video game Control by Remedy Entertainment. Within it, there is the oldest house, a location that can only be found if you're looking for it. Otherwise, it is completely passed by. Twin Peaks has the Twin Lodges representing the places of good and evil that are purportedly based on the beliefs of the Nez Perce, but I think actually draw from the book Psychic Self-Defense by Dion Fortune, where the lodges align to right and left-hand paths of magic, which kind of mixes up their meaning, the eponymous warehouse and Warehouse 13. What kind of special locations do you see paranormal investigation fitting into in a mage game?
Aside from just, you know, your chantry where you go to store all of your ill-gotten gains, the things that the technocracy is trying to hide from the world, your other world construct that you reach through your chantry.
For me, the big ones are the restricted collection of the libraries of Dwizzetap that hold poorly understood artifacts that your characters may be granted access to, quite simply because no one cares about you. I think one of the things that is understated in Mage is the usefulness of your characters in being somewhat disposable. We get the idea that sometimes Cassandra Complex within the technocracy shops out missions to the traditions, not because they are the best qualified, but because if they fail, they will be the least missed, at least in the eyes of Cassandra Complex. The technocracy also has deep sea or Antarctic facilities where research can be done with less concern for the mortal population. We have Arcanum chapter houses that collect oddities, the Nagoma Grand Scroll Hall, which collects bits of knowledge left by the various invading forces that have tried to subjugate them over time. I imagine there's some odd bits of the Akashic Record or dreaming that characters can enter to store or consult weird knowledge. And as Bryce mentioned, your chantry or construct.
Akashic Record or dreaming construct that you make. Hey, look, we finally found a use for the domain background. It occurred. It happened. It was bound to come up after 25, 30 years of Mage.
Did domain, was M20 the first time it actually hit print, or was it one of those things?
No, it was in Guide to the Traditions.
Okay. Did it actually do something useful there and then M20
Absolutely
forgot?
Absolutely not. No, oh, okay. 100% no. Okay. I'm pretty sure it was a direct copy paste.
It couldn't be a direct copy-paste, because when things are copied from revised to M20, they become wordier and still no new information is added. I feel like in M20, above the golden rule, there was the platinum rule of revised sucked, ignore it, that I kind of take personal offense to.
Electrified.
I did too. I think it had the best core book of any of the editions.
Absolutely.
Yep. Another common genre convention is team dynamics. Like, there's going to be people with varied expertise. What do you consider to be like the common setup for paranormal investigation, or one of them that you would look at and go like, yep, that's your standard paranormal investigation group?
Well, you have the person who knows everything, the expert. You have the person who beats things up when needed, the hitter. You have the people person, the grifter. You have the person who is there to take out the artifacts, the thief. And you have the person who is there to get around whatever security measures might be in place. A hacker, as it were.
One thing that's often there is kind of like the every person that reminds the audience of the ridiculous of the scenario. So you can just have like, you're like, yes, we have our hacker, we have our thief, we have our occult wizard, we have our know-it-all, and this is Jim, he's our intern.
And here's Xander, he's there to help.
Help remind everyone why everyone else is cooler. I don't actually know. I was never a Buffy fan. I think I watched 5 episodes in total, so.
I've watched the entire thing once, decades after it was on the air.
To, like, win a bet?
No, because I'd never seen it, and it's this thing that, you know, keeps being referenced in other media, so.
Buffy has hit that echelon where if I run into someone who is still quoting it, that tells me more about them than it does about the thing that they're referencing. Like, at a critical point, it became like, oh yeah, I was on the high school like football team. Great, buddy. You're 39. No one cares. In building out a mage game, this is going to kind of vary between what your group wants to do. So in the technocracy, you may have a subject matter expert, which could be a changing NPC or a character that has the ability to change their understandings, possibly by downloading new little modules. Hypercram, the technocratic version of Dream. I remember the first time I saw Hypercram on a character sheet, and I'm like, yes,
My favorite background for a technocrat.
A stealth and recon character that gets stuff, a strong arm if something goes bad, a human intelligence character that may be able to get information either subtly or not so subtly. This may vary for a ghost hunting team. You may have a technology person, a social media expert who moderates the team's appearance, but also gets donors and leads, a ghost talker or a medium, and a spiritualist who isn't necessarily a talk to ghost person, but maybe a know about person team. Have you seen other variants of like the necessary elements, as it were?
The Fallen World team, just like a religious group that hunts down demons and angels, or in the World of Darkness, a group who's cleaning up after the Bangladesh incident during the Week of Nightmares. Someone's got to go in there and ride herd on all the sleepers who saw the Bodhisattva wake up and start laying waste. Urban legend experts who deal with tulpas, demons, or spirits. So for that, you're going to want to have a researcher who is pretty good with technology, maybe a different researcher who can look into the people on the ground, who knows the local legends and the lore. A face. You want someone who can be there to talk people down using the information provided by the first two. A closer, somebody who goes in there and actually, you know, beats up the bad guys or seals the gateway to hell or what have you.
Yep. Whatever the, we don't want this to have happen again unless we want it to have happen again because we agreed that we wanted it to have happen again person.
That guy.
And within the technocracy, each of these steps could be an entire team. One of the things I propose later is I'm terribly curious what like a paranormal investigation game that were like troop style would be, where we get to go through the field agents that find out about weird things happening, the research team that figures out what's going on, and then the response team that is like, I have a grenade. Is the monster vulnerable to grenades? Yes. They're all
for the purposes
vulnerable
of this conversation. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
They told me so in the briefing.
Exactly. It was specifically under the weaknesses section. Explosions. Kind of another key idea in the paranormal investigation genre is the accumulation of clues and evidence. This differentiates it from certain other kind of genres. Investigation also often involves various lines of evidence and may include finding diaries, scientific experiments, videos and photos, conversations with witnesses, other mystical insights. But rarely is there like a single linchpin, like if you were doing a courtroom drama where you're trying to have the Perry Mason reveal moment where you're like, but you forgot about this, which always threw me off because I'm like, wouldn't that have to have been entered into evidence ahead of time, and wouldn't they get to see that under cross-examination? But anyway, I was no fun as a small child. I haven't changed
not
much since then.
But dramas work.
Yeah, exactly. And then you have the variation on that. You have Columbo, which instead of a whodunit is the whydunit, which I always thought was a kind of an interesting spin on it. So in these games, we're generally accumulating a bunch of arrows pointing at the culprit, the entity, the nature of it. Supernatural investigation generally doesn't have a recourse to an arbitrating body like a court of law. So it's not like, well, we got the evidence. Time to tell the police. The characters are frequently going to be judge, jury, and executioner.
Although now I would kind of like to see a Law and Order version of this where the people are represented by two equal forces, the technocracy who goes in and enforces the law and the courts who go in and mete out punishment on those who break the law.
That would be great alternatively if like Azathoth, the primal chaos, is like the arbiter and just in the end just consumes everyone every time. That's a game I wouldn't play. But still, it may be the case though that your characters need to accumulate sufficient evidence to justify a response from your organization. So the thing with a technocratic union and many other groups is not the fact that there isn't anything to respond to. It's the fact that there's too much to respond to, and you need to come up with enough evidence to indicate, one, that a group of people will be able to deal with this thing, and then two, that it justifies their time. Otherwise, you've just filed a report and that will go into a large vault somewhere. One could create a pool building mechanic where each clue you find adds to a die pool that the first team rolls, and you get to find out how it goes. So I like the idea that you're just doing the investigation part, but if you don't do a good enough job, your friends in tactical response may not make it through this encounter. And that's partially because I'm a sucker for pool building mechanics. What are your thoughts on this?
Information gathering is usually, in my experience, one of the most difficult aspects of an investigative game. If you fail or botch a roll, does that mean that you just miss the whole entire important piece of information that tells you how to deal with this threat? Ideally, that is not the case. I recommend only rolling in investigation or really any time you might be tempted to roll some dice. There's a fun outcome for failure. Fun doesn't necessarily mean woohoo, yay. It just means more than you miss with your sword. Now we move on to Jim, who swings his axe. If the possible outcome is you are stuck in your investigation and you cannot proceed because you did not get the next clue, that's not fun. If the outcome is more you spin your wheels for a while and whatever you're investigating gets more powerful or difficult to deal with, but you do eventually find that clue to move forward, that's more fun. But I mean, if the outcome comes down to, oh, you missed that roll, so world in, sorry, roll up some new character, we're going to start over, that's really not fun at all.
Yeah, the big thing for me is the clues at what cost, what disadvantage do you have in not having a piece of information? And frequently, I will do what I refer to as outcome shifting, where a failure means you only get one clue, success means you get two clues, a botch means you get your one clue, but some other sort of Damocles is kind of hanging above your head. The other kind of key thing with investigation is frequently your characters will be vastly more understanding of things than the players are. So this is a case where someone can just say, in my opinion, so using my investigate, I look for clues. Good enough for me. If I needed to know as much as my characters did, I would play remarkably boring characters that were all moderately successful accountants, actuaries, and financial people, which would be the true world of darkness.
So technocrats.
I mean, sleepers. My favorite thing is always when someone on Facebook is like, what would David Blaine be in the world of mage? Sleeper. Next question. We answered this question.
Billy Banal. Next.
Yeah. Another key idea of the paranormal investigation genre is the unexplained phenomenon. Some aspect of what's happening in the world does not fit within kind of known science. If everything is mundane and you're still investigating things, that's just a detective story, which can also be fun, and I am in no way opposed to. I kind of like the idea of a reverse supernatural game where it is supernaturals investigating mortals and mundane thing. A Scooby game where the characters are trying to find evidence of an Umbrood or a new awakening, but all of them have actually entirely mundane explanations. This works well in my world of mage where magic is exceedingly rare.
A series of mundane events that lead to supernatural outcomes. Wasn't that the plot to Unbreakable?
Well, this is supernaturals investigating things that they think are supernatural, but they always turn out to be mundane. I actually haven't seen Unbreakable. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. It's not good. It's M. Night Shyamalan. Can't recommend it.
I think the most impressive movie trick M. Night Shyamalan ever pulled was convincing people that Bucks County was mostly cornfields. And I'm like, I don't think you understand how much suburb there is in this suburb. Like, you wouldn't get that unmitigated view of corn except in one spot. Where did he film it? That one spot.
That exact one spot.
Exactly.
Yeah. He didn't say the whole place, just this one specific spot.
How dare you make my home county look that interesting? So above the level of things never having a supernatural cause would be mages hunting mages and tying up kind of loose ends. This is the least spread from the core conceit of mage. An abandoned call has reactivated after a string of gruesome killings, and the nearest node has become a feeding ground for spirits of decay, destroying the local water infrastructure, poisoning the town. This is something with a supernatural start, but it may have ultimately mundane fixes to it. At the end of the day, if the spirits go away, you still have water infrastructure to fix.
Yeah, your river's still polluted.
Yeah. How do we get rid of this river spirit of pollution? That, I don't know, the Clean Water Act? Like, I've always started off by people who are like, well, we clean the spiritual aspect. Surely the material aspect will be fine. Yeah, in like 20
years.
It'll
clear itself up. Yeah, that's how that works. Right. Ask the werewolves. They know.
Literal decades, yeah. How are we going to stop this embodiment of entropy and destruction? Breaking things. Mm-hmm. You're
punches.
Yep. Fight guns with guns. That's worked out.
As a Texan, I approve this message.
Maybe after the Avatar Storm, a number of shallowings got stuck on the mundane side of the gauntlet, and the group needs to figure out what the nature of these odd stuck bits are and try and reconnect it to the Umbra before problems start. A particular part of the Inventium fell into a local warehouse, which becomes a makerspace of some renowned, but constant exposure to such possibility has caused mental health issues for the sleepers. Maybe they quite literally can't sleep anymore. They are so full of ideas, or they start looking at the world around them in some strange way that starts causing problems. The characters need to find the four impossible objects that were taken home, marking it as number realm, and return them to the box in the Great Hall to return the shard to the Inventium. So maybe they find a Penrose Triangle or something out in the world.
That guy who built Escher stairs in his she shed out back for the wife, and he hadn't seen her for a week.
Yeah. I have built a low power stairmaster. It just goes up. Maybe children have been hearing stories of their own death due to a local fountain being connected to the Well of Souls. The characters need to place in the fountain the skeleton of someone very young, very old, and someone yet to be born. So good luck with that before it will return to its appropriate location in the Umbra.
Sounds like a difficult one to overcome.
It is.
Although, boy, I guess with time magic, it can't be that difficult, right?
Yeah. One level of abstraction up from that is Nightfolk and Urban Legends. These are games about finding the werewolf behind destroying the logging equipment, or the vampire killing the homeless, or the Ventru who's slowly going through their supply of World War II veterans, or what have you. I tend to find these games not interesting, as this is just kind of the default World of Darkness that people tend to play in. How do you deal with it, Bryce?
I tend to see the previous example as more, you know, mages dealing with other mages and the fallout thereof as the default for mage specifically. If you don't want to deal with the Ventru who's running out of his, you know, particular flavor of blood, or the Geth of Fenris who's, you know, tearing up the logging company, you don't have to use Eru and you don't have to use Canites. You can just use werewolves and vampires. You can change things for your game. It's the golden rule. It's a great rule.
I think one of my favorites was I had players who were like, I think it was a werewolf. And they all looked at me and they're like, are there werewolves in the setting? I'm like, I'm not answering that one. And it just turned out that, like, for every clue I had laid out, they're like, ah, yes, further evidence that is blankety blank. And one guy would be like, or a werewolf. It actually turned out to be kind of like Umbral Space Amish. So at the end of it, one of the guys like, can't believe the Umbral Space Amish turned out to be werewolves the whole time. And I'm like, now that's a supplement we need. Kind of the exact opposite of the Umbral Pilots book that's on the Storyteller Vault. Like, what if we went into the ether with wood? Pepperidge Farm remembers.
Yeah.
And then kind of the one level of abstraction beyond that is in 2E, and then more so in Revised, we get the idea that, like, urban legends were an actual thing, that cryptids were out there. They could be strange organisms that are natural but real weird. Maybe Nessie the Mothman and Bigfoot are just weird biological creatures. Mortal technology hasn't been able to track down the Loveland Frog, which is a 4-foot cryptid from Loveland, Ohio. I'm slowly becoming far too familiar with the cryptids of Ohio to prepare for my Hunter 5th Gen Con games. We could be in a world where tulpas exist. If a community believes something hard enough, it manifests. If enough people think their dogs have been killed by chupacabra, you got yourself a goat sucker there, buddy.
Wouldn't that be a chupapero if it ate the dogs?
Reasonable, yes. Yeah.
Words have meanings. Cobra means goat.
Whale sharks, neither whale nor a shark.
However, nurse sharks, all RNs.
That's actually why they stick to local waters. They have to keep up with their continuing education. Or these entities could be returning Umbrood or bygones. An area has the beliefs or resources to support some sort of materialized Umbrood. In Dark Ages, we get the idea that bygones and such are able to extract tasks they need from certain things. I always like the fact that it's like, yeah, everyone contains tasks to a dragon, but virgin tasks is just easier to process. And I'm like, oh, okay, virgins, they go down smooth. Thanks, World of Darkness. The investigation now comes down to what the creature is and what it needs to survive.
And how to deal with the mortal or mortals in the area that don't want you to deal with it or get rid of it. To use movie references, Jaws, they want people to keep coming back for their local festival of the Loveland Frog Festival, or Lake Placid, where Betty White loves that giant alligator. Don't kill that. That's her baby pet.
I do like, what's the meme? Remember your local elections? The mayor in Jaws 2 is the same mayor as
Jaws 1. Mayor in Jaws 1.
So this is generally where the World of Darkness kind of stops, but in Paranormal Investigation, informed by these other media, it can keep going to yet weirder stuff that don't often get a lot of screen time. For instance, it could be wonders. In Revised, we get the idea of there being intelligent wonders and devices that can cause all sorts of issues. And this can be combined with a Sanctum, a Node, and it can have Arcane and Dark Fate, because I actually think that's kind of a cool system. So Haleakara's Crossroads is an ancient relic serving as both a Node and Sanctum, but with considerable Arcane. Mortals who wander into it begin having strange dreams of the red sands of the Dream Realm. If anyone were to bring a boat here, they'd be able to come through the shallowing to some place in the Maya. And maybe during kayak season, one out of every 10,000 cars just kind of disappears there if someone gets real sleepy late at night.
Oh, I started watching a show on Amazon Prime. It's called From. I recommend it.
I thought, like, you were about to say the Langoliers and we were going to not be friends anymore.
No, the Langoliers is hot garbage. Absolutely not. It's actually from MGM Plus, which I learned existed because I watched this show.
What other weird things do you think already exist in the World of Darkness that mages could wind up investigating?
Materialized spirits. You know, a lot of spirits have the materialized charm. They can just, you know, show up and hang around for a while and then go back to wherever they want to go, wherever they came from, stuff like that. That'd be fun to deal with. If you had a weaver spirit who's somewhere just putting things in order, which isn't necessarily an order that you recognize or that is healthy for the environment or things that it is putting in that order. If it puts all of your atoms in order,
yeah,
from, you know, hydrogen on up to whatever, you know, uranium you have floating around in you from nuclear tests 20 years before you were born, that's not going to be real good for you, but it is definitely in order. And, you know, maybe some mages want to stop that from happening.
I do like the idea of having a spirit with an attack entitled Alphabetize, being like, oh no, he's being alphabetized. Yeah, maybe Knot is a Lost Paradox spirit that used to punish arrogant Arabian craft mages that at some point was canned by the Taftani, has been released, and has been causing all sorts of issues with anyone doing kind of precise work, as that their goal was to kind of fight against pride and hubris. They're neither Jinn nor mortal nor paradox spirit at this point. So how do you deal with this walking calamity who kind of misses the bazaar of Baghdad of their youth?
I feel bad for him.
Exactly. Mascot! In Revised, we get the idea that there are objects in the High Umbra that have strange semi-sentient properties. There could be an idealized Stone of Scone, which descended in Topeka, Kansas during the Week of Nightmares or after some sort of umbral quake and now appears as a park bench. Anyone who sits upon it thinks of themselves as the king of something, which causes all sorts of issues as five people claim to be mayor and every member of a band thinks that they're the front person. The term for that, I think, is Oasis.
I prefer rather than anyone who sits on it thinks they're the king of whatever. Anyone who sits on it is actually, until the next person sits on it, the king of whatever they think they're the king of. If I sit on it and I think I'm the king of cats, you better stay away from me because you will have an allergic reaction.
Sting sits on it and becomes the king of pain. This could end very poorly. What other weird sources do you think we have within the world of Mage?
Well, if we want to reach outside the world of Mage, we can go all the way up to space, which is kind of hard to do because the World of Darkness space is just another part of the Umbra, or
not.
The Umbra is also space,
yeah.
But it's also the depths of the ocean, because as above, so below, and as long as people haven't been there, it's all the same place until we go there and make it some other place. Not aliens. You don't want real aliens, because that's kind of dumb, but, you know, could do a color out of space kind of thing where a meteor crashes somewhere away from a huge population center, but it has some sort of negative effect on the area that it lands in. Maybe starts changing the local paradigm there to something a little more esoteric, a little more out there.
Yeah, I was always curious what it would look like to have mystic aliens as opposed to technomantic aliens in Mage. But yeah, maybe you have an invasive plant from the cop that finds its way into a small town near Tbilisi, Georgia, with an absolute lovely smell. And anyone who takes a whiff is driven to rebuild the city that it came from, full of Metatopian architecture. Soon people are remodeling their homes to be cylindrical pyramids, and strange tasks of fear appears in the form of Yitvit fruits coming from trees. So how did it get here, and how do we stop its spread? Sounds like a game to me.
That sounds like the Southern Reach.
A little bit. I only read the first one. I don't know how it ends. Are we all just boned in that book?
That's a great question. I read all three books and moving on.
Okay.
There are no answers to that book.
The first one is a page turner. I'll give them
that.
The
first one is great. The second one is dull as dishwater. The third one is definitely also a book that exists and I read.
As you can clearly see from my Goodreads listing, I have read it.
It brings back characters from the first two books. It tries to tie things up, but because of the nature of the thing, it doesn't really. If you want me to spoil the ending for you, I will happily do so. If not, say so now.
So that's a thing where I read it on Wikipedia at least twice, so it has been spoiled to me, and the ending was apparently unremarkable enough that I don't actually remember it. Coming up with the paranormal thing to me is not the hard part for this. The two big things are, one, that system set up, and two, kind of like how to do this. The World of Darkness wants, at least notionally, to be a horror setting. I say it needs to try harder if it's going to tell me that. But like, one of the first questions is, can the characters trust other characters? These are all questions that I would kind of want to have established, not necessarily in a session zero, but I would want the group to kind of agree on as we got into it. Some people prefer a conspiratorial game where someone may be a mole, or at least each mission includes a, so what should we do about it? Where different people are vying for control. Maybe they keep it secret. Maybe they set the thing they discover free, or maybe they destroy it. As you mentioned, a obviously sentient weaver spirit manifests as a very large spider that is slowly repairing a small town that has fallen into disrepair. Some characters wish to let it do the work, viewing it as the mending power of stasis. Others want to return it to the Umbra, where maybe someone else thinks they could take it to a spot where it could do much more good.
I like the idea of a cabal of hermetics that get sent out to check on weird things that come up, being sent to investigate reports of a Nephilim having awakened nearby. Some people in the Chantry want to recruit the angel-blooded person. Some people want to use them as a lure to get, you know, dad to come down from heaven so they can do whatever they do to angels. Some people want to just kill this abomination outright. So what side do the players fall on? What do they do if some are on side A, some are on side B, and some are on side murder?
And that's something where there's frequently no right answers, and there's going to be repercussions to all of them. If you murdered this thing, well, that certainly takes care of it for now, but maybe a little light of wonder has been snuffed from the world. If you keep it around, you now have this Nephilim whose dad may be interested in your goings-on. Yeah, there are clean answers, but there are no necessarily best answers. You may default to the characters can trust each other at least to start. Characters may discover divisions within the group over time, so as players realize who their characters are. One of the fights may be how much is it worth to go along to get along? And again, these are mages and they all have willpower 5 at least. One character discovers a bit tied into their past, and this kind of makes a unique offering for play. The Order of Gold Enlightenment wishes to banish demons, each of which is a unique weakness and means of control. Holly realizes that the group is dealing with Jinx, Dreambreaker, who she summoned decades ago and she thought she dealt with. Does she tell the group that it's her fault? I don't know.
I hate it. My childhood imaginary friend comes back and turns out to be real and also a demon.
Yeah, I could deal with one or the other. The growth matrix is a pot that causes first repair, then malignant growth, and whatever is placed in it. And it needs to be destroyed to kind of prevent this mutant kudzu from sprawling over the landscape. But what if Mickey's character is pretty sure it can prevent her brother's death and reverses Huntington's disease? Worked fine for the first four or five missions, now suddenly can kind of drive the group apart. What other like points do you see this being that this can be on?
One thing that often comes up in my games is I don't like to play characters who are okay with just killing people as a solution, but often that is not the case with others in my group because it is a very expedient solution to the problem we have at hand, not necessarily the best solution long term. And I've, you know, tried to get them to understand that, but, you know, whatever. But, you know, sometimes you just want a group of people that trust one another, you know, us against the world kind of deal. It might seem boring not to have internal conflict, but, you know, we're not playing vampire here. It lets you focus your stories on other things rather than interpersonal, inter-cabal conflict. So maybe you don't always follow the orders that your boss gives you to a T. But if you decide to do that, then everybody goes along and does that. And if you decide not to do that, then nobody turns around and, you know, rats out the rest of the group.
The well-known copper rule in Mage, snitches get stitches.
Exactly.
One of the lesser known precepts of Damian. Yeah. Maybe you're a member of the etheric response team, which receives directives to destroy impediments to wonder until they discover a cognivore, which is eating stray thoughts. While technically this creature that kind of nips up these bits of new ideas is an enemy of creativity, your group decides it has a right to exist and it doesn't seem to be causing issues. Like, who cares if it eats some bad poems at a middle school and some mediocre songs by an emo band? It may come back to be a problem later, but the important part is everyone agrees and stands by it, though. This is one of those things that kind of, once you have broken your group's rules and stood together, there is now a stronger bind within the members of your subgroup than between the members and whatever their parent organization is.
Yeah, but those poor Chimera, they just wanted to live, Terry.
Frequently in these kind of games, there is a handler, a person who provides missions, resources, and represents something further up the pyramid of the organization. For instance, in Esoterrorists, one of the key things is whenever you get a directive from a Mr. or Mrs. Verity, they will never lead you wrong. They are not going to purposefully lead you into an ambush. They have never led the Ordo Veritatis agents wrong and even holds themselves to a higher standard than the agents hold themselves to. Mr. Verity has changed appearances over time, but has never let the agents wrong.
Or sometimes you have a handler who requests the agents do something, you know, a little outside their comfort zone morally. But, you know, if they do, then the handler has their back. They have the support of the handler and presumably the greater organization as a whole if they do the mission properly. A gray suit that the special response team Delta has indicated the group must dispose of, I don't know, just a college professor or a guy writing on an archive of our own, just a fanfic writer. Your handler says, hey, you know, getting rid of those guys, it's vital for the security of the nation, for the security of reality. They don't do anything obvious to you or your group, you know, you were told. Maybe you can talk the handler into not outright disposing of them. But if you do, then, you know, you gain prestige. You towed the party line. You did what was asked. And now you look better in the eyes of the whole organization.
You know what we do to people that fulfill arbitrary objectives very well in something that is essentially meaningless? Give them multi-million-dollar sports contracts.
Exactly.
And then one level of remove from that is there may be multiple handlers with cross purposes. The handler may be concerned about you rising in the hierarchy of the organization, and you may need to balance multiple directives and multiple bosses. This becomes a game of politics as well as a game of paranormal investigation. One at Sinistratus has told a recent Barabbi that they must steal a keystone piece of tainted sculpture from a museum exhibit, but another one has told the Barabbas that they need to leave it in place so that it can corrupt the people there. What to do? The financiers wish to see enrollment in a particular private school increased by 30% to see that venture is expanded from essentially two dots to three dots, but the ivory tower within the NWO wishes to see attendance at local public schools increase to see that everyone in the area is receiving the appropriately adjusted curriculum. So it is not uncommon that there will be people at cross purposes.
And this is how you play the faction game in Mage. You know, we discussed this, I believe, during the Blades in the Dark, where you have different factions. They each have different faction clocks. If your group does something for one, it causes their clock to tick up and causes their rival to tick down. So now you have one group that is beholden to you and another group that is angry at you. And now you're stuck in between these two much more powerful groups. Have fun with that.
Yeah, and they may have access to different resources within your chantry. You've made the progenitors happy, so your bullet wounds are pretty easy to patch up, and maybe the iterators are quite fond of the efficiency of your work, so it's very easy to get your vehicles repaired. But your paychecks aren't coming through for some reason, or your checks bounce, or the dossiers you get are subtly inaccurate for some reason. So I wonder what could be going on there. And as Bryce said, when we talked about Blades in the Dark, we talked about the faction system there as a way of gaining boons and debits and so on that can all come out in the play of a game. You may represent this by a spectrum that starts balanced at five, and that within the technocracy, for instance, you may have the unionists and the utopians or something like that.
Something like that. Utopians was definitely one of them.
Yeah, you may have the Unionists versus the Utopians. Within the traditionalists, you may have the complementarians, and you may have the belligerents. Within the disparates, you may have the accommodationists, and you may have the preservationists. Every group is going to have at least two political factions, and anything you do to advance one is going to put you in hot water in the eyes of the other, unless you find a way to pull this off with particular aplomb. If you are able to make your success obvious to the people who like you and not to the people who don't, this is now an additional thing that you want to do during that ending part of a paranormal investigation, kind of your veil out. Kind of another key question to me is, what is the nature of your investigations? At the lowest level, investigations are ad hoc. You stumble into them. In the course of trying to find a lost wonder, the characters encounter a strange cube that seems to follow people around, invisibly robbing them of a night's sleep. Each time it successfully takes a night's sleep from someone, it goes to someone else, and the cube gains another face and goes from being six-faced to seven-faced and becomes a little more sentient. So what happens if it goes to completion? One level up of that, the characters are investigators on their own. It may be the Dr. Atomic's Etheric Detective Agency or something like that. They have a network of strange happenings from weird inclined mortals to other mages or supernaturals, and this gives them connections to all sorts of people. This is useful, especially in a game, if you decide to do cross-line play, and you kind of get to see what everyone thinks of everyone else's special thing. This requires crossover rules, so good luck with that. But if you
Harry, there are 20 or 30 contradictory sets of crossover rules. Just pick the one you like best.
Yeah. I just like the one in Dreams of Nightmares where it's like, no, magic doesn't work in the dreaming. Nope. You know what magic in the dreaming is called? Arts. It's like, anyway, what other investigative frameworks do you see in games?
The framework where characters are investigators as part of an organization. They could be investigating weird cultural phenomena for the disparate alliance to try to preserve them. Say that the group is approached about an odd mobile node that seems to be something more than just a person. What is it? Is it a god? Is it a monster? Is it gods and monsters? Is it Holly Berry? Who knows? The Waydown has noticed an increase in the number of shallowings and mortals stepping through them with terrible results, as opposed to all the times mortals step through them with amazing results. What's caused the gauntlet to get thinner? And what do we do with the odd, strange mortals that return saying that they were in the underworld?
These games can be both about investigating and deciding what to do, as well as trying to take advantage of this before another faction can leverage it. In just about any phenomenon, you can turn it into a race by going, oh, by the way, the Nefandi are also curious about it, or, oh, by the way, blank is kind of interested in what's going on. And kind of alternatively, your characters may just be part of a group that does flat out investigating. You may be in charge of finding leads, documenting them, and exterminating them. As I mentioned before, I think this could lead to an interesting troop play scenario, as you all get to be information gatherers, then all get to be researchers, then all get to be part of a first response team of some sort.
That would be fun. I agree.
Yeah. The answer that no one wants to the question everyone has, troop play. Kind of the next one for me is, are the foes internal or external? It may be the case that most of the threats comes when you return to your home office. You've neutralized the threat, but everyone has thoughts on how you should have done it. Success puts you in some people's good graces and not in others. While House Flambeau is thrilled that you ended the Keel-In that was menacing your hometown, House Bonnie Sages is kind of annoyed, as their claws are quite potent in poultices. The drives may be more personal. You have two Bata'a Manbos who have each given you different directives on how to best support a particular region of Haiti, and ultimately you kind of have to pick one. Even if stopping the Bokor from raising a zombie army is good for everyone, one Bata'a family may simply not like the praise you've garnered for your lineage.
Yeah, next time let the zombies rise. It's much easier than your family looking great. But what if it's a secret conspiracy? You know, rather than the obvious, you know, office or internal politics that we mentioned previously, say that the organization was infiltrated with spies who have different agendas, or they're from other groups entirely, maybe entirely unknown to your organization, like a group of Yathanatoi Golden Chalice members who have repeatedly targeted members of a technocracy construct, only to find that these requests are actually coming from NWO agent who is trying to get rid of dissidents and traitors or people that are just in his way.
Alternatively, the secret conspiracy is the real organization. Only operators canny enough to find out that there's something amiss get promoted to this conspiracy within a conspiracy. A group of citizens, sorcerers, and newly awakened have been doing favors for the Society of Aether's shadow ministry, only by realizing that their directives have been both unethical and involve hyperscience can the teams actually kind of say, there's something else going on here, and join the Society of Aether. Maybe one out of every six missions to a black suit team clearly violates the precepts of Damien. And until the group says, nope, this isn't who we are, can the group as a whole advance from T1 to being T2s? There's a conspiracy within a conspiracy.
So what does the play cycle look like in your idea of a investigatory mage game?
The thing about an investigation game is you need to bridge kind of the question of the moment with the game overall. My first thing is this a one-shot? If it is, catch the characters at the end of doing something absolutely badass. They're killing a Primogen, they're slaying a Black Spiral Dancer, they're subduing an Umbrood, they're trapping the Sphere of Darkness, what thirst for human flesh in a high-powered game. If it's a lower-powered game, they're coming off of some sort of success, unmasking the evil landlord, or burying that cursed doll at the edge of town. But to me, the cycle kind of goes, the mystery is introduced. This may involve a flashback to the creature or entity doing its thing. The sentient garbage can with a taste for deadbeat dads consumes its latest victim. If it's going to be pretty apparent what the item is, I have no problem just kind of handing that to the characters. Cube representing the color blue appears in a dream demanding that you procure and destroy a painting by Yves Klein. And sometimes there may be more than one to go after. This is something I do when a group returns from the Umbra or from being abroad for a while, where I kind of give them a newspaper of weird events that they get to follow up on. But otherwise, the characters have some initial encounter either firsthand, secondhand, or thirdhand with whatever the weirdness is. And what happens, Bryce, after we find there's something weird going on? What do we get to do?
We get to do the most fun and exciting part of any game. Research! Now, this could be technical research. It could be human intelligence, where you go, you talk to your contacts. It could be occult research, where you cast spells to scry on where you think the thing might be. It could be internal investigation where you, root out that conspiracy that this turns out to be from the head of your construct who's just killing off people who are in his way. I like that guy. He's going places. Yeah. But whatever it is, you want to have something for everybody to do. So if someone's just playing Jim the Fighter who shoots things with his gun, let them play a forensics agent or maybe pursue a side goal involved, in Jim the Fighter with his guns. Let him do something, go down to the shooting range and talk to the guys there, do some human intelligence gathering there. If nothing else, a character can do some sort of prep work that can provide a benefit moving forward. So in this particular investigation, the face has very little to do because there's not a lot of people left from the trash can that Cincinnati. So he will try to go talk up somebody in the quartermaster's department in requisitions to provide help. This could be something where they get immediate equipment that they can take out into the field or something that they can use later at appropriate times where they could, reveal that they always had it and they only just whipped it out now because now it's important. I mentioned earlier scrying. If taken literally, that can be incredibly powerful. So make sure that your character who has time to correspondence to is neither just an automatic win or completely useless, because those are really the two ends of that spectrum.
Scrying can frequently present a problem. Kind of the way I deal with this is by using everyone's favorite Chronicles of Darkness system, Gates, which is basically a way of lumping successes together. So to me, during the "so what's your research" phase, anyone who gets three successes gets us something. You either get a clue, you get information about a special means of dispatch, a way of dealing with this thing, you get a token that you can turn in later in case the odds fall against you and you suddenly remember, oh yeah, this thing is vulnerable to sand or something like that. I want everyone who did everything kind of useful to get something. If it's particularly well attuned, maybe they get two of these, or they only need two successes. If it's particularly esoteric as a way to investigate, they need four successes to kind of throw something into the bucket. And this also, to me, is a good way to kind of have something in the back pocket if they suddenly realize they forgot to bring hand grenades or something like that. The most important thing, to quote Robin Laws, is the least interesting thing in an RPG is playing the game of guess what the storyteller is thinking. So if the characters come down an avenue of investigation, they're like, we're pretty sure it's this. 75% of the time, it's at least partially that for me, unless it really fits in into something. Any thoughts on the research phase?
Do whatever you can to make it interesting, because as everybody who lives in the real world knows, research on its own is sometimes entertaining, but it's not really the most interesting thing to role play. Try to make it interesting or entertaining.
The other thing we learned from the real world is in all group projects, almost all work is done by a single person. So yeah. I think it's also reasonable to have an internally facing person, the person who's really good at interfacing with requisitions to get you something, or to position yourself for a great payout if you're able to do this, or to secure extra resources, even if you don't necessarily need them, but you're like, yeah, I really think access to the Chantry's node is going to help us for this. You should let me have two helpings this month.
I would also caution against everybody always having their one role and sticking to it. That works even the majority of the time. Yes, okay, you know, the face needs to talk to people. The guy with the gun needs to shoot people. But it gets boring and samey if you do the same role every time. So, you know, maybe split things up, maybe, you know, move those jobs around on occasion. Just, you know, keep things interesting.
Yeah, normally you're a requisitions person, but Mark's ex-husband is currently in charge of this area and they did not leave on good terms. So maybe that is not the person we send into this. Or someone has been reprimanded for using violence far too many times. So maybe you don't get to rough someone up this time. Your character that is constantly scrying through time. One of my favorite examples is you've used Ring of Truth 30 times, the Entropy 1 effect to detect if someone's lying, and now you just constantly have ringing in your ear. And for the duration of an investigation, you have kind of a two-point flaw in the terms of any human speech just kind of sounds like a bell choir. There are ways to shift it around. Characters should always have an opportunity at some point to roll the big meaty dice pool of the thing they are good at. They should not necessarily automatically get to do that every time.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
The next part after that is kind of the showdown or discovery and completion. This can take a couple of forms. You contain the object, you destroy it if necessary, you save people back to their normal form, you kill the entity, or what have you. Frequently in a lot of games, esoterists introduce an idea of special means of dispatch, which is the thing that the thing is unusually vulnerable to. Within Chronicles of Darkness, when dealing with the God Machine, certain bits of infrastructure are known as linchpins, and that if they are destroyed, a whole bunch of activity of the God Machine is destroyed in this area. This allows for entities that are powerful but aren't like bullet sponges and reward characters doing their homework. And this is part of what your research phase can kind of do. There's kind of a phase I left out, the veil out, which is kind of where you cover up for what you did, depending on what the nature of the organization is. If your goal is to maintain some idea of normalcy, a veil out is the part of the mission where you're like, and everything was normal all along. To me, in a technocracy game, that's probably the thing you're going to be most graded on. It's almost better to let the bad guy get away as long as no mortals know that anything had happened.
Yeah, for a technocracy game, absolutely. Because that's their job. They're preventing mortals from being aware. If you're a group of etherites tracking down crashed UFOs in the Nevada desert, maybe witnesses isn't the worst thing in the world to have running around saying, hey, there's aliens. That's neat.
And then your game may or may not have a downtime phase. This may be where you consider the fallout for the event. The ever-updating photo album that keeps including pictures of an alternate conspiratorial history has been recovered, but a bunch of conspiracy theorists were able to make photocopies where JFK made it to a second turn, and another one where Reagan was successfully assassinated. So, No, I'm not going to... Yeah. I'm like, how do I make a wistful joke? Maybe you had to use your anomaly nullification armament to stop a self-replicating neon sign before it consumed all the power of the city's grid. But have people noticed that there's still maybe 200 or 300 extra neon signs in a weird script that no one can read? What are we going to do with those? This may also be a time for you to take care of personal stuff. Frequently, this is described as downtime, which I don't particularly like. It is just kind of a less active phase where it is less time intensive, and it allows you to pursue maybe more individualized stories. I generally like the idea of mixing this up with side scenes, as they're called in Invisible Sun, take a drink. There may also be a processing period where you get to say, well, we took care of this. What raise did we get? Did we get a new thing added to our armament? We domesticated a hound of Tyndalos. What does that give us?
Some really rounded poop.
I do like the idea that you're like, how do you get a hound of Tyndalos to the vet? And it's just like this, the sphere. One investigation may imply another. The rainbow shards are bits of the first rainbow, each tuned to a particular feeling. In this mission, you neutralized yellow six, which caused his cowardice and sloth. But this apply that there are other ones out there. What is a mythos? Like, you hear, after you have enough of these Monsters of the Week episode, there's kind of a thing that is behind it. What do you think are, like, the questions we need to ask to set that up for our long paranormal conspiratorial game?
If you're going to have an overarching mythology that you're trying to tie into in your investigation games, then you're going to have to uncover at least two of three things. When did the organization start? Are you just the next in a long line of slayers stretching back to, you know, prehistory? Or did your grandpa start this hunting agency? Has the nature of the investigations changed in any way? Ideally, if you started with the Teutonic Knights, you're no longer putting on the plate mail and going out hunting down the Arab invaders of the Holy Land.
The Saracens.
Them guys, yeah. So, you know, hopefully you've moved your things up a little bit. And finally, has the backers of the organization changed? So your group originally worked under John Dee, but after, you know, the 80s, when Thatcher government started doing all the budgetary cuts, turns out that the Department of Weirdos and Strange Things, that wasn't worth the cost. So now it's a commercial entity. It's a public-private partnership, and they sell skills and abilities to the highest bidder.
One thing to keep in mind for me when setting these up is Mage doesn't have a lot of true truth, which actually makes certain kinds of games really hard. Like, I try to avoid a mythos where we're just saying some paradigm is wrong. For instance, providing proof that angels are just aliens, and then that aliens are just genetically engineered humans, and genetically engineered humans are just people with demonic taint, and demons are just generic spirits of humanity's evil, and spirits of humanity's evil created angels to prolong humanity's torment. Like, try not to say this thing that this group believes is actually this weird other thing. My recommendation at that point is to have some phenomenon that may be informing both or is masquerading as both, rather than just saying these people are wrong. Unless you're playing 1E Mage, in which case a lot of that book was going, these people are wrong, but kind of in a fun way.
There's only one true paradigm, and it's right here in this big purple book.
Yeah. And the last thing I kind of want to cover is, this isn't just for technocrats. House Bonnie Sages and House Verdicious investigate strange places and entities, trying to figure out power tied to the past. The Hakachi's Keepers are Moonseeker members of the Verbena that see strange phenomenon as proof that mythic threads can be coaxed back to life and encourage wonder. The ecstatic researchers in the Manifold Way find ways in which dreams and desires of humanity can be manifest in weird ways, and they investigate those things. The Etheric Adventurers are constantly trying to find new sources of metascience. The Kopa Loe research novel manifestations of lost Kapu, allowing them to rediscover new mana sources. The Hollower Fellowship of the Forgotten feel kinship with strange objects with their own rules that no one understands. The Chorale of Frozen Song investigates odd examples of the notes of the One. The Wulong are always willing to find how wayward objects fit into their celestial hierarchy. The Static Instantiation Dismissal Committee of the NWO views odd phenomena as a way to study how the consensus can manifest and then be destroyed. And the Errant Hypernarrative Retrieval Group is a syndicate entity that views strange objects and entities as a way to view what the consensus really wants but doesn't know yet. Are there any other groups in Mage that you think would have a paranormal arm?
I think that they would all have a paranormal arm. They all want to, you know, they all want to come out on top. So, you know, the best way to do that is to amass resources and have more of them than your competitors. So, yeah, everybody wants everything. Well, not everybody wants everything. You know, some people don't want those guys to have this thing, but that means that we have to hold on to it. We don't want it. It's just something we have to do.
Yeah. I don't want it so much as you can't have it, which is known exactly. as the Big Brother philosophy, but in like the familial sense as opposed to the George Orwell sense. So we've talked a bunch about paranormal investigation. You're generally the one of the two of us that has had literally any contact with culture. Where do you go, or what do you think some good sources of inspiration for paranormal investigation games is going to be?
I read a lot of nerdy books. So I would recommend The Rivers of London, which is a series about a group of modern day magicians who are in the employ of the London Metropolitan Police Department. Very hermetic, very interesting books. I'm waiting for the next one to come out. The long running TV series / cultural phenomenon, Supernatural, is about two brothers who kill monsters and save people and eventually get into a fist fight with God. Also, they punch Hitler at one point. The Laundry Files is just an absolute blast of a series. It's two series now. There's a spinoff series about the British Secret Intelligence Department tasked with keeping Cthulhu mythos entities from destroying reality as we know it using computers. The Dresden Files is a long and excellent series of books about a wizard in Chicago who is also a private detective. And finally, the grandfather of them all, The X-Files. Everybody knows The X-Files. It was on Fox back, you know, when Fox was brand new. It is about two FBI agents who are searching for the truth, which they assure us is out there.
I think my favorite variant of that is the UFO picking someone up that says, "Get in, loser, we're doing butt stuff." And that to me is a sign that it's really gone. I think it's hard to talk about this without mentioning the SCP, the Special Containment Procedures Project. The problem at this point is using SCP as a direct source is hard just because there's so much crap in it. It really got hit by Sturgeon's Law. So my recommendation is if you're looking for weird objects and such, Google best SCP objects and then go from there.
Or just listen to their podcast. They tend to pick the good ones for the podcast.
Yeah, we'll include a link to that in the show notes. And a lot of these slot very well into MAGE. For instance, SCP-3008, the perfectly normal, regular old IKEA, which is an IKEA that people just kind of get lost in for years. It lacks windows.
We use that in the cult game.
That makes sense. There are store associates wandering around that are kind of like hunting the inhabitants. This could be a new zone that pops up and you step sideways sometime and you wind up here instead. Or alternatively, there is a shallowing in a appropriate IKEA that leads to it. Another one is the extraterrestrial space horror of SCP-3001, The Red Reality. This is kind of a space that you can find yourself trapped in that is just kind of red. You have the Plague Doctor, which just goes around kind of spreading pestilence and then kind of disappearing. And the other thing that is introduced in SCP is the Global Occult Coalition, which is another group that is trying to do things with it. And there's a mix of sometimes we need a weird object to subdue another weird object, and other times someone wants it for not great reasons. I guess another one, ironically, that I almost forgot was SCP-055, the anti-meme, which is...
I was going to say the Anti-Memetics Division.
What's that, Bryce?
It is SCP-055 and SCP-2256, which is... Okay, so SCP has some things that if you learn about them, you have to be made to forget. But there are some things that will automatically censor itself. So they have some people who have to take anti-forgetting drugs, so they will remember that these threats to reality are out there so that they can prevent these threats to reality from succeeding in their threat. There's an ebook from an author known as Quantum, Q-N-T-M, called There Is No Anti-Memetics Division. It is a read. It is real good. It's very strange. Very mage.
I very much like the back cover thing of Welcome to the Anti-Memetics Division. Today is not your first day.
Yeah.
And for inspiration for me, the game Control is gorgeous, and it has a wiki that is very easy to navigate. It is tight. It kind of gives you an idea of what an internal conspiracy can look like. It has an interesting cast of characters. It uses ray tracing. So if you have like an RTX card, it looks absolutely gorgeous. And those are kind of the big things that I look at. Any other thoughts on paranormal investigation as a genre in Mage?
I think we've mostly covered it here. Did a good job there.
Bryce, as our... What did we have you as chief blank correspondent?
I'm the chief mythos correspondent, Terry. It's on my business card.
It threw me off because the problem is Josh Heath and I did an episode on cosmicism, and that kind of... That's like the one thing. But I didn't even know you yet then, so... So as chief mythos correspondent, what do you think we should talk about next? I guess it would be we should finally do our Void Engineers episode.
Absolutely, we should finally do our Void Engineers episode. Not just space episode.
Yeah. They're everywhere you want them to be. The master guard of the technocracy. And if people are interested in finding out what you're up to, Bryce, where can we do that?
You can find me on Mastodon. I'm at sandchigger@dice.camp. I'm also one of the hosts of Darker Days Radio, which you can find at darker-days.org. From there, you can find our Discord, and I'm always on there. Hang out. I lurk on the Mage the Podcast Discord. Just at me. I'll respond.
Bryce, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me, Terry. It was fun.
This has been Mage the Podcast, where if you went missing under mysterious circumstances, we'd totally go looking for you. Eventually. This episode was made possible by Sean Gallagher, Oracle of that creepy house at the end of the street. Ben Bendelow, Oracle of all the escapees from Kirkbride Mental Hospitals. Buck Gregory, Oracle of the odd saying that comes from that particular crate in an unnamed warehouse. Christopher Phillips, Oracle of that weird glove that always wins at rock, paper, scissors. Guy Stewart, Oracle of the weird things found in Alfhold dollhouses. Josh Hillerup, Oracle of abandoned poutine factories that sometimes start to work again in the dead of night. Puka G, Oracle of the unfinished septa lines that people say they can swear they've seen trains go down. Jay Widener, Oracle of the secret system of mailboxes the Illuminati uses. Mikhail, Oracle of the agent who was killed by the sentient void just 3 days before retirement. The crew of Erebus, Oracle of the secret Roman or Egyptian roots of seemingly every secret society. Come on, people. The Assyrians and Babylonians are right there, along with any number of other cultures. Just add some variety, please. Additionally, thanks to Archmaster Andrew Edelstein, Archmaster Brad the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Semsick, Archmaster Leroy Bryce, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Nathan Weaver, Alex, Alexia, Ampaversion, Anders S., Anon, Bedurfi, Berto, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Bubba the Pale One, Chris Blake, Sinchotis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, Darren Hennessy, Dave Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwenk, Frager Rock, George Lara, Henry Kraft, Ia Bolt, Jason Kennedy, Jason Vines, Jason W. Briggs, Jay Gatsby, Jeff Brin, Jenna F., John Magnuson, Jolyn Andes, Laws and Stuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Proyle, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nathan Weaver, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick McNamara, Patrick Mulder, Rachel Grace, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Rubem Joseph, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Starfish, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Connolly, and William Martin. Our EP shout-out this week is to Darren Hennessy, who I assume is the scion of the Hennessy Performance Engineering firm which manufactures hypercars in America. I didn't know what a hypercar was, but it's apparently something that can go from 0 to 60 in 3 seconds or less with a top speed of between 200 and 300 miles per hour. One of their first offerings was a tuning package for a stock 1996 Dodge Viper, which ran about $108,000 and made it one of the fastest road-legal cars in the world. That feels like a 3 dots of resources with a lot of savings or 4 dots of resources with a little penny pinching kind of thing. In 2010, they debuted the Venom GT based on the Lotus Exige, which clocked in at 271 miles per hour and had 1,244 horsepower. Three further, this came in at 2,743 pounds, making it roughly 500 pounds lighter than my 2017 Subaru Impreza that can only reach 271 miles per hour in a free fall with some rocket assistance. When I see a hypercar on the road, Darren, I'll think of you, or possibly Cognac, but that Hennessy is spelled differently. Thank you for your support. Rather listen on YouTube, search Mage the Podcast on YouTube to find our full library there. If you super like this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at magethepodcast@gmail.com or at magethepodcast on Twitter. We have a Hop in Discord community at discord.me/magethepodcast. Mage the Podcast is also at Mastodon at dice.camp/@magethepodcast. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to magethepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye.